You are listening to the extended version of Sexy Marriage Radio, smrnation.com.
You've turned on Sexy Marriage Radio, where the best sex happens in the marriage bed. Here's your host, Dr. Corey Allen.
So it's still hard to believe sometimes, babe. This is Corey Allen, alongside my wife, Pam.
Hey, folks.
Sexy Marriage Radio. That next week is the 8th birthday of Sexy Marriage Radio.
It's kind of cool.
October 11th is when this whole thing started.
Yeah, yeah.
And so here we are 8 years later.
Yeah.
Almost.
Great.
We're 1 week shy of 8 weeks later, 8 years later. And here we are, still going.
Yeah.
In large part, thank you to the Sexy Marriage Radio Nation for helping make all of this happen. Because the feedback that they give, the comments, the questions, it's a great relationship that's been created and continues to evolve.
Right. Just by listening and knowing that people are enjoying the content and getting something out of it and creating better lives, that's what it's about.
And the way you can let us know that is you can call our voicemail line, 214-702-9565. You can also jump on the inbox world and email us at feedback@sexymarriageradio.com.
Or feedback, whatever.
Feedback, that's kind of an interesting, how do you even spell that? If you like what we're doing also and you listen via iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify or anything, that rate and review the show. Leave a comment. Help spread the word that married sex can be great and it evolves, and marriages can be great and evolve and can be lifelong, because we want life and marriage to be vibrant and alive in every aspect that takes place in your life. So coming up on today's regular free version of Sexy Marriage Radio is an interview I had with Dr. Stephen Stosny, who is an author of lots of books. But particularly where we went with this conversation is something we've not ever really covered on Sexy Marriage Radio is the whole arena of verbal and emotional abuse and how it plays out in marriage, and his belief and work that says compassion is an important aspect to overcoming and changing that dynamic.
Right.
And so the whole entire free version of Sexy Marriage Radio is our conversation.
Wonderful.
And then coming up on the extended version, which is deeper and longer, and there's no ads, and you can subscribe at smrnation.com, Pam and I are going to have an in-depth conversation about how meanings disrupt and get in the way of desire and arousal when it comes to sex. So all of that is coming up on today's show. Joining me for this section of Sexy Marriage Radio today is Dr. Stephen Stosny, who is the author of 9 books. The most recent one is Empowered Love. And the reason I'm reaching out to you, Stephen, is when you're dealing with marriage and you're dealing with married life, and as that goes on with two humans most of the time, then we're talking about all kinds of different emotions that can come up throughout the course of a relationship. And sometimes those can get into some of the quote unquote darker side of things that would be where it's on the verge of or is definitely emotional abuse, verbal abuse, even physical abuse. But it's an area that it impacts a lot of marriages. And I'm interested in you and your take on what are some of the best things that we can do? Because when I'm looking at your research and your work, that's an area you don't shy away from. And so how can we address that as clean as possible as married people?
Well, emotional abuse is when you deliberately try to make your partner or children feel bad about themselves so they will do what you want.
Okay.
There are behaviors that are abusive in intimate relationships that would not be abusive in other relationships. And the reason is abuse is basically a misuse of power. And when you're in a love relationship, you have enormous power over the emotional well-being of the other people in the relationship. So you've got to use that power responsibly. You can't deliberately make them feel bad about themselves just because you don't like their behavior.
Okay.
Or because you want them to do something.
Okay. And so what about the times? Because this is what comes to my mind is I love the idea of deliberately doing it. But what about the times where we kind of get caught in our own blind spots or blinders of, well, I'm not deliberately doing, that's just the way they feel.
It doesn't matter if your intention is to hurt or not.
Okay.
When you recognize your partner is hurt, that's all that's important. Your intention is not important. the trick of sincere connection in a relationship is to focus on the hurt, not on the intention. And the irony is, if you do that, you know, gosh, that hurt you. I'm so sorry. You don't have to say you didn't mean it because it's obvious from your caring that you didn't.
Okay.
So when you say, oh, well, you just feel that way. I didn't mean to hurt you. Then it seems like you did mean to do it. It creates a consciousness of guilt.
Okay. And that's an interesting realm. Yeah. That's an interesting realm where marriage really takes place a lot, isn't it? That there's this dynamic of what we say and the secondary message built into it, or what we do and the message is built into it. And so what I'm hearing you say is, how do we start to recognize the messages I receive back can be great data for how am I dealing with myself and the relationship? What are the consequences from what I do or don't do?
Right. And what you're defensive about is your ego, not your deeper values. We call it core value. Your core value is to protect the emotional well-being of the people you love.
Okay.
That is the most important thing about most people, to protect the well-being of the people they love. When you violate that by hurting the feelings of the people you love, you're going to experience guilt and shame. But the guilt and shame, if you blame it on them, will come out as resentment and anger.
Okay. So what do you do when you recognize that in your relationship? And I think we need to take both sides of this. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but it's if you are the one that's the perpetrator of this, if you will, and versus the one that you're involved in that with your spouse.
You know, it is not really the vulnerable emotions, the guilt and shame or fear that causes the abuse. It's the coping mechanism. And the abusers will use what I call the toddler coping mechanisms. That's blame, denial, and avoidance.
Okay.
We start doing that at two. You know, if a two-year-old breaks the lamp and you ask them what happened, they'll blame it on somebody.
Yep.
My daughter was an only child. She used to say, Jimmy, do it. That was her imaginary friend. She's now a lawyer because she figured out that the Jimmy defense.
There you go.
Very good.
make a life out of
work,
it.
If blame doesn't work, denial. I don't know. And that's kind of what you do when you say, I didn't intend to hurt your feelings. Or avoidance. The toddler will hide when the lamp is broken. And blame, denial, and avoidance are what produces emotional abuse in adult relationships.
Okay.
It's a retreat to the toddler brain. And if you're in the habit of doing that, you'll be doing it automatically. Now, everyone has a toddler brain and everyone is susceptible to retreating to it under stress.
Yep.
All animals, not just humans, but all animals retreat to previously learned habits under stress. So you're likely to blame, deny, and avoid. The trick is get to the vulnerable emotion, the guilt, shame, or anxiety. Those will drive connection. The guilt is telling you violated your core value. Make up for it by connecting to your loved one.
Okay.
Don't blame it on your loved one. Connect with them.
Okay. So if you recognize that you had a pattern of being toddler, then you're saying don't just do that as the reaction. Try to get to the deeper, what's my feeling from that reaction? And then that can hopefully steer me and align me with my values that I've had all along.
Yes. I feel guilty and ashamed that I hurt my partner's feelings. And if I get in touch with that, it'll motivate compassion for her.
Okay. Is that just kind of a natural thing in what you found?
If, excuse me, it is if we allow it to be, if we don't short circuit it with blame.
Okay.
See, the you know, it's interesting if you look at other social animals, when they will be, usually it's inadvertent, they will hurt each other playing or roughhousing, that motivates, they'll start licking each other.
Okay.
Humans have evolved something that other animals don't have, and that's an ego. So when we hurt our loved ones, we want to defend our ego.
Okay.
Come up with some excuse for it. And that's why humans are the only social animals who will use anger and aggression against loved ones.
Okay.
No other animal does that.
Okay. And it's self-protection or self-identity as far as
No, it's ego protection, not self-protection.
Okay, fair enough.
Anger evolved in social animals to override self-protection.
Okay.
When will you get the angriest if I attack you or your children?
Okay. I got you.
Anger evolved to protect loved ones. We subverted the natural function of anger and transferred it from protecting loved ones to protecting the ego.
Okay.
And that's really why you have family abuse.
Okay. And so,
because of the ego.
So what's a spouse to do when they recognize this pattern either in themselves or their spouse?
They have to replace blame, denial, and avoidance with improve. How can I make this better rather than whose fault it is? Appreciate your partner more. Connect, you know, feel what your partner's feeling, or protect. Any one of those.
Okay.
Those are the adult coping mechanisms. But because it's a habit to blame, deny, and avoid, you've got to develop new habits to improve, appreciate, connect, or protect. I call that emotional reconditioning. And that's really what our boot camps for chronic resentment, anger, or emotional abuse do. It builds new habits.
Okay.
But you're going to like yourself better. Think of, you know, we all have a little bit of resentment for people we love. Because, you know, it's a stressful world. They could, and resentment is a perception of unfairness. Relationships can't always be fair.
Right.
Not every interaction can be fair.
Right.
It's too complex a world.
Right.
So there's going to be some resentment. So think of yourself when you feel resentment for your wife. And then think of when you feel compassion for her. And which do you like yourself better?
Okay.
Feeling resentment or compassion?
That's an easy answer.
Yeah, you'll always like yourself better feeling compassion for someone you love than resentment.
Okay.
It's hard to like yourself when you're resentful. And that's your central nervous system trying to communicate with you.
Okay. So
do what'll make you like yourself
better.
There you
go. Right. So this is about creating a better relationship with myself through the whole thing too.
Right. Because everything you resent about your partner, you could also feel compassion about. And everything you feel compassionate about, you can also resent. It depends on how you look at it.
Okay.
What I want my clients to see is they like themselves better when they look at it compassionately. And
right.
They like themselves less when they look at it resentfully. Right. And also the resentment is very contagious. So if you're resentful to your wife, you can bet your mortgage she's going to be resentful back.
Right. Yeah. Because it's tit for tat in some regards of I'll get what I'm getting.
And yeah, well, there's a law of motion and interaction called positive reciprocity and negative reactivity.
Right.
If you approach a partner or a social animal positively, about 70% of the time you get a positive response. And if you approach them negatively, almost 100% of the time you get a negative response.
Amazing how it works that way, isn't it, Stephen?
Oh, well, negative emotions get priority processing in the brain, so they're always more salient.
Okay. So you mentioned that in some regards, it's about creating new habits. If I start to recognize that, man, I am quick to blame or I'm quick to deny, or I have some of those skill sets, quote unquote, that I've been following that's not really helping in the long run and in the overall
it's making
scope.
It much worse.
Right. Can you give an example of what would be like a habit that someone might start with that would adjust that process?
Well, do something very trivial. It happened in my house this morning. My wife banged a dish really loud on the counter, cracked it a little bit. And I wanted to blame her for that. But I said, oh, honey, did you cut your finger instead?
Okay.
And that made it much better. She had a much more positive response. And I liked myself better. but my habit was to say, you know, would you be careful? What's
right.
wrong with you?
What are you doing? Okay.
Yeah.
So this is just almost a learned thing of just recognizing my tendency. And it's not necessarily, tell me if I'm wrong with this. It's not necessarily, I don't have that thought or that reaction. I just don't follow that through and make it the visible one. I go a different route.
Once your brain's developed a habit, it never loses it, but you can always extend it. In other words, the old habit, the blame, is going to condition the new habit of improve, and you actually build a conditioned response. Now, it takes about 800 repetitions over several weeks for
okay.
that to become automatic. But the way it works, like after our boot camps, after about 6 weeks of practice, something will occur, something will be annoying or devaluing or ego threat, and you'll just improve it. You'll make it better. And after that, you'll think, you know, if that happened 6 weeks ago, I got really upset.
Right.
Here I just made it better.
Right.
What's happened to me?
All these changes going on. I blame you, Stephen, even though it's a good change. So,
right.
Okay. So if you are on the other side of this as the spouse that is being treated in these manners, what's the best steps for them?
Well, it's the same thing. They have to look at themselves more compassionately and their partners. Now, compassion means to suffer with. It's not about behavior. They can condemn the behavior and still be compassionate
okay.
to the vulnerability that leads to the behavior, because a person's much more likely to change if you're compassionate than if you're resentful back.
Okay.
See, it's... Your choice is, if you're living with a resentful person, you are almost certainly going to become resentful yourself unless you are compassionate. And that's your choice. Now, if you're more compassionate and your partner doesn't change, your relationship is going to end, just because
right.
When you're more in your core value, you gravitate toward what raises the value of your experience and what get away from what lowers it.
Okay.
So if you're with a resentful spouse and your spouse doesn't change, then you'll probably separate.
Okay. And so you've mentioned this a couple of different times when you're talking about when you're more to your core value.
Yeah.
That how do you capture that? What do you exactly mean by that?
Core value is the most important thing about you as a person. Just think off the top of your head, what is the most important thing about you as a person?
Okay. So it's just one of the things that really do define you as who you are.
Yeah, but I help clients with that because it's not an easy question.
Right.
And for your listeners, I'll go through the exercise. Imagine you have children, your children are grown. And they have their own families. And God comes down and gives you a choice of how your adult children are going to feel about you. Choice A is, you know, Dad was honest, loyal, hard worker. The reason I picked those three things, we used to do research on core value, and those three things always came up: honest, loyal, and hard worker.
Okay.
Those are important, but they're not the most important.
Right.
So mom and dad were honest, loyal, and hard workers. We're not sure they cared about us, but they were honest, loyal, and hard workers. That's choice A.
Okay.
Choice B is mom and dad were human. They made a lot of mistakes, but we always knew that they cared about us and wanted what was best for us.
Okay.
What would you choose? A or B?
B.
See, for most people, the most important thing about them is being compassionate and caring to the people they love. Now, we know from research that's almost universally what late life regret is.
Okay.
Not being loving and compassionate enough.
Okay.
To the people you love.
Right. That's
almost universal.
Right. That's that proverbial, you're not on your deathbed going, man, I wish I would have worked more.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You get a little presage of that. You don't have to wait till you die.
Right.
You can get a little presage of that If somebody you love dies,
right,
a parent or somebody close to you, even if you had a real close relationship with that person, there's this little voice in your head. Did he or she know how much I love them? Did they know how important, did I make them know how important they were to me?
Right.
That's because attachment was instrumental to human survival as a species. So you always have that little doubt about it. And that doubt's going to come out usually when it's too late. Now is the time to prevent regret.
Right.
I see myself as in the regret prevention business.
It's not a bad one to be in, because if you can help people create a life that has less of it, and in turn is replacing it with the whole idea of compassion and connection and true value that you can offer and get with other people, man, that's a much more depth of life and living. Right.
So core value in a relationship is, you know, I might want my partner to do something, but I don't want her to do something that's going to make her feel uncomfortable. So I am always attuned to her emotional well-being as well as my own.
Okay.
But in an attachment relationship, if your partner isn't well, you're not going to be well either.
Right. Right.
Your emotional well-being is tied up with one another and with your children. That's the bad news, is if they go down, you're going down with them. The good news, if you build them up, you're going to go up with them.
Okay. So where does the world of building myself up to build them up go?
Well, self-compassion always has to be in balance with compassion for loved ones.
Okay.
That means you're not going to be Mother Teresa self-sacrificing all the time, because that's not really compassionate in an close relationship, because it doesn't give your partner a chance to be compassionate.
Okay.
Compassion is the healing emotion. If to really deeply understand the hurt of your partner is to heal your own.
Okay.
It's not really getting compassion, it's giving it that does the healing.
Right. Because I get exactly what you're saying, because when we receive something, it doesn't create what we get when we actually give it.
Right. And if you're getting compassion without giving it, you're liable to construe it as pity and start to resent it.
Okay. Well, that's a slippery slope then.
Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of people get offended when you are compassionate to them, because it makes them feel guilty and ashamed. They don't think they deserve it, one, and they don't think they can return it.
Okay. So with all the work that you're doing, because I love the idea of trying to just help people recognize that we got to move out of some of these normal instinctual reactions at times that we can have that are habits that are built deep down, and almost move it to a higher level processing of evolving. Yeah,
but let me correct you about one thing.
Okay.
I think it's returning to the instinctual habits.
Thank you.
By building new habits. See, the instinct of a child when they feel hurt is to connect. You know, they're going to run to mommy and daddy and hug them.
Okay.
And they will continue to do that until mommy and daddy start punishing them for doing
okay.
it. And then they start blaming, denying, and avoiding.
Okay.
So it's returning to the instinct.
Okay.
And following the motivation of the guilt and shame, which is to connect.
Right. And
to
so
reinstate the attachment bond.
So summing this all up, the real goal is, how do I learn to view and then approach things that are through the compassionate lens?
Right.
Through some of the ways that maybe we were intended all along to be doing.
And that we do under emergency. You know what I always ask people to test, because chronic resentment will eventually destroy a relationship. And if you are resentful in a relationship, you are almost certainly going to become verbally or emotionally abusive.
Okay.
Because it has a retaliation motive. You feel like you've been hurt and you want to get back at that person.
Okay.
So a good way to know if you're emotionally abusive, if you're very resentful.
Right.
You won't know that you're abusive, but you certainly will know that you're resentful.
Okay. That's good. That's good. So, Stephen, thank you so much for spending some time with Sexy Marriage Radio Nation today. And I want to let everybody know, how can they find you and more of what you do, the 9 books, the boot camp, and the different courses and webinars, the different things you offer? Where do they find all that?
The best way is at our website, compassionpower.com.
Okay. And that'll all be in the show notes. So, Stephen, thank you again for your work and for your time today. All right, Pam. So, as we move into the extended content this morning,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different things that come along. If I look at the breadth of all the different types of clients that come through my doors as for therapy or for coaching,
mm-hmm.
And the theme that goes through a lot of the emails and voicemails that come through, you can land them in the idea of desire differences, right? That,
sure.
That's an easy way to frame it, to at least start to make sense of it. And that's the principle that there's a higher desire and a lower desire in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about sexual desire, whoever has the lower of that controls it as far as the actual sex happening.
Right.
Because they get to accept or reject any initiation attempts from the higher desire.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times what I've come across and just trying to help formulate is there's a lot of times where a woman, and I'm going to put her, the wife, in the lower desire category.
Okay.
For the purposes of our conversation. But even with men, and maybe it might even be heightened a little bit more when the man is the lower desire, because they come in feeling like they're broken. Like there's something wrong because they are unable to have desire, or they don't have desire. And so they come in thinking, I'm broken.
Okay. I'll let you go there. I would dispute that as the lower desire, I guess I don't think I'm broken. But let's roll with what you got.
No, explain that because this is just... this is just postulating on my side from what I'm seeing as the therapist in this situation.
Sure.
So
you see a lot of people in that regard. And I don't doubt that that's what a lot of people do feel, because they feel like, well, because I don't want it as much, maybe I am broken. I don't see it that way from my point of view. I guess maybe so many discussions with you and listening to your show... I realize it is just a desire difference.
True.
And it's okay. And there's other areas of life that I want to eat healthier than you do. I'm pretty sure you don't. And so I'm the higher desire for
correct.
Eating healthier food. I'm pretty sure you don't walk into that aspect of our relationship because you're the lower desire for healthier food and think I'm broken because I don't want healthy food as much as Pam does.
Fair. But that also is on a topic that we don't both have to be participating in to achieve a goal. It's easier when we do, and I'll posit as I'm talking.
I was going to say, from your perspective,
sex
it's hard.
The same way,
right? It's hard from the other spouse's point of view if one spouse is eating.
Yep, it makes
French
it,
fries and pizza all the time.
The path is much more difficult,
right? So within the relationship, yep. That makes it difficult as well,
right?
But I think people view sex on a whole different level because of that, because it's
absolutely
kind of that taboo subject,
and
right?
So just as we start this framework with the conversation, it's important to recognize that there's a difference in my mind, and we've talked about this in the past with some of the shows. There's a difference between I don't have desire, but I can be responsive.
Yes.
I don't have desire, but I can be sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have desire, and I can achieve arousal.
Right.
All of those are different facets of this conversation.
Right.
You cannot lump them all together in my mind.
And my guess is it's not always I don't have desire. It's just maybe I don't feel like I have it very often.
Okay. That's fair.
I guess I'm posing that question to you of what you're saying. Is it typically no desire?
Well,
or am I just nitpicking at things that
it probably goes into the category of no desire, but or more aptly stated low to very low desire. And And that's where, again, it's just recognizing that where does desire come from is a difficult path to try to unpack for people.
Sure.
And we're going to try to get into that some
with this
extended content. But there's also just seeing it as, I want to go with the more larger lens of the sexual interplay and the dynamic between husband and wife, mm-hmm. between partners, to be able to see it as there's basically, when you're talking about sexual desire problems, they can spring from three different sources. And this is some stuff that Dr. Schnarch has talked about in his book, Resurrecting Sex. So you can have medical issues that are impacting it, which, because he has the premise and the foundational belief that most everybody on the planet is capable of sexual desire, of experiencing it.
Okay.
But we get a lot of different things that can get in the way. And so one of them is medical issues or physical issues. And so if that's the case, then you're talking about a primary physician that you need to be working with, an OB, a doc of some sort that can help explore what are the different physical manifestations that could be going on that is impacting my ability to be sexually responsive, to have any kind of levels of desire, because it could just be some chemical imbalance or too low, or, you know, there's a lot of different things that could come about. So medical or physical issues. The other one is insufficient stimulation to create arousal.
Okay, so is this typically coming from within in my own brain, or is this maybe my partner has no clue of how
it's
to
both. I would say you probably have to put it into the end of the category of both.
Okay.
That it's the whole concept of I'm not getting out of my own way, which is where we're going to go with the third part, and that's where we'll land in just a minute. But I'm not getting out of my own way in my own head. And then there's also some environmental factors, because it could be I'm married to somebody that's kind of klutzy when it comes to the whole element of creating an environment of arousal, because it's been way too one-sided, or it's just utilitarian, or, you know, so there's a lot of different things that when you're talking about insufficient stimulation to create arousal, that also goes into a factor of stimulation to achieve orgasm. Because you could put it all together, even though every single one of these aspects could be a show in and of itself.
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot of details.
There's a lot of nuances, and they're going to be varied as the people that are listening.
Mm-hmm.
So insufficient stimulation to create arousal. And then the third one is the attributed meanings to your sexuality and your relationship. And that's where I want to land.
Okay.
Because this is the meanings that we have in our sexuality is one of the most important factors when it comes to sexual desire and functioning.
Okay. So how do you see this play out? Give me like a real life example here.
So the easiest way to frame this is when you think of a relationship when you're dating at the beginning and you're both flooded with that obsessive chemical, and it's that season where you can't keep your hands off each other.
Yeah.
Right? At that point, the meanings of touch is completely different than the other aspects of your life and the meanings that you attribute to touch.
Okay.
Right? Because you're taught, you're raised in a family where you're either higher on the affectionate scale or lower on the affectionate scale. Parents model that typically.
Sure.
Do you hug a lot? Do you hold hands? Do you sit close to each other? You know, there's a lot of different aspects that make this up. And typically speaking, if someone's raised in a family that's where touch is lower, they likely will gravitate towards somebody initially where the touch is higher, because that's just the way we are as people. And during that initial startup phase, both people are way on board with it, because whoever it is that's lower on the touch scale is loving the fact that I'm with somebody that can't keep their hands off me.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that obsessive chemical fades and disappears, and typically then marriage is in the picture,
mm-hmm.
now all of a sudden it shifts to, they can't keep their hands off me.
Yeah, I want my own space.
And even on the higher desire side of that, they have the whole, I love that they play a little hard to get.
Okay. Right?
There's a chase to it because they might have grown up in a situation where touch was so easy and expected that there was this element in their brain that's like, I kind of like the challenge of this. I like the fact it comes across, the fact that she's so averse to touch in some ways makes her come across so independent.
Okay.
Right?
I see this. That right. makes sense.
Okay. So you could recognize that as life is unfolding and marriage is taking place, the different things that play out, the meanings we attribute to it make all the difference.
And so when I'm dating, I'm not thinking about the meanings. I just...
They're not as right? compounded and deep.
Okay.
Because there's just a synergy and a flow that happens when you're in that stage of right. the relationship. There's an obsessiveness and a longing that makes you both chemically high, yeah. if you will. And so as that fades, and then the relationship starts taking place, and then kids come into the picture, which changes the dynamic and alters the meanings even more.
Oh, even more.
And
yeah.
And so there's lots of different things that start, or job changes, or career shifts, or loss, or you know, there's all these different factors that can derail this path, and they make us always have to renegotiate the meanings that we have with things with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Which this is where a lot of people don't do the work. If I don't spend the time examining and renegotiating meanings with myself, I spend the time trying to renegotiate meanings with my partner by trying to get them to do it the way I want them to do it. Rather than, how do I examine what's the dynamic on the meaning I'm attributing to this?
And really, what's the best? Sometimes it takes someone else to really open your eyes to the fact that you aren't looking at the meanings behind it.
Right. Right.
Right. So at what point do you, how do you know how to examine those meanings?
Well, so that's a great, that we could come at it both sides of kind of from a negative side and then even from a positive side. I don't even like that terminology with negative and positive because that makes one sound better than the other. And I don't think this is a hierarchy of this is the way you should.
Okay.
I think it's probably best to look at it from one side versus the other.
Okay.
That one of the ways you start to examine it is you look at the dynamic and how the interplay takes place between the two of you sexually, on the energy that takes place between you.
Uh-huh.
And you start examining, okay, what is it that can bring about such an adverse reaction from me when my spouse does X? Why do I respond that way? Because the likelihood is when spouse did X at one point in the marriage, it actually produced something positive because we are creatures of habit. You know, I think of one of the things you and I love is just traveling and vacation, especially when we get the opportunities to go just you and I.
Right.
And there is an element that happens with a lot of couples that, you know, you got a romantic weekend scheduled. And while that can be a great... Oh, this is a great getaway. That can also be tremendous pressure because, man, there better be some sex happening because whoever set it up, that's part of the point of it for them. But the lower desire could be going, okay, now there's going to be pressure because he's going to be wanting sex or she's going to be expecting this.
Sure.
Right? Where at some points in your marriage, you likely both couldn't wait to get away and even have sex, you know? And so there's just this element of, those meanings change, and it's because we are meaning-making creatures, and we're the only species that does this, by the way, of making meaning out of things. Because dogs can have sex, but they aren't worried about their performance, and is she liking this? And they're just, it's just a physical thing.
Right, right? Yeah. Get back here.
Right.
Come on, I'm chasing you.
But we, as humans, get caught up and we can be having sex and then we're not even thinking about the actual sex we're having. We're thinking about, does he like this? Is he enjoying this? Or why am I not responding the way I want to? Or, man, what, this isn't working, you know? And you get so caught up in all these different things because you just get derailed by the meanings.
So if I'm not looking at and asking myself, why is that bothering me? What's the meaning behind it? Right? Or we've got spouses out there that are listening, or we've got one, our listeners, maybe one spouse listens and the other doesn't.
Right.
Right. And, right. and you got one that says, wow, I wonder what meaning they attach to XYZ. Cause I saw them in whatever move I made.
Yep.
I could just see that wall come up.
Yep.
How does the one that's listening deal with that? Is there a question they ask their spouse?
No, that's fair. Because
to help on this journey when you've got potentially one that's not listening to hear that message of, oh, here's the question I should be asking myself.
So the way you would bring this up in my mind is you would approach the non-listening spouse to Sexy Marriage Radio, at least.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to say they don't ever listen in their entire life to anything.
Right, right.
But you approach them and say, hey, Sexy Marriage Radio did an episode where they were talking about how meanings are the ones that derail us. And it just got me thinking of the meanings I have on life and our relationship. And I would love to hear what yours are as if something comes to mind. And it's just kind of, you do a more macro introduction to it. And then if you want to go deeper, you go deeper by sharing what you're learning about you.
Okay.
I've discovered this about me and the meaning. And I need to challenge that because there's this, then that's using the pressure and the dynamic cleaner.
Yeah.
Rather than, I need you to join me on this so that we can have, and you hold all the cards and. That doesn't solve.
It's kind of staying in your circle. Because I guess what the way I was thinking of it, I like your approach. Because mine, I was thinking this could wreak some havoc. Because I'm thinking, oh, I saw something happen within a sexual encounter. And afterward, I say, hey, you seem to get mad about that. What was that? What meaning do you attach? I'm like, wait a second.
Then it's going
to
be defensive. I wasn't mad.
Exactly. So my thought process is
I get it.
This would be bad.
It's a common thing that we do because I put too much onus on my partner for my well-being.
Yeah.
Rather than recognizing I got to bring the reins into myself more. And so I need to start looking at the idea that the meanings that I attribute to things during sex is what helps determine how my body will respond. Right. That's what I've got to look at. And I don't mean sex just as in the actual encounter of intercourse. I mean sex as to how we are as a sexual being in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are constantly communicating about things.
Right.
Everything. So what are the meanings of that communication? What do I attribute to it? And the way I start with this, because this goes back to the flip side of how to look at this.
Mm-hmm.
One is look at, okay, why am I reacting poorly? Because typically we have awareness enough to be able to go, yeah, I didn't handle that well. That was different. I was I was short. I was mean. I was, you know, dismissive when they brought that up or when that happened. And so if I'll take the courage to be able to go, what was that reaction from? That's a meaning-seeking process.
Okay.
The other is when you're driving along or whenever you have a little bit of time for yourself and you can just be a little more broader in your scope of how you want to look at your life and challenge your path on how it's come to where it is, you start to look at what are the messages that I've been taught and bought about sex and sexuality? Because we're raised in a culture here in the West that America's not a sex positive country.
Yeah.
Right. It's not treated. If you compare America and sexuality to some of the cultures in European cultures, where we as Americans would say they are just way too free, but there's an element of that freedom is actually a little more positive than the negative shame that we have here in the West that can easily start to be taught. And it's unspoken and secondary, but it gets embedded in kids' minds. And if you're raised in a church, it's embedded in your soul, it feels like.
Right.
Of that, you know, sex, because from my upbringing, and I can speak to yours because we had a very similar upbringing when you talk about the religious circles, there's an element of, I wonder if our sexuality was actually God-given in the way it was approached as a child. With that topic, right? Rather than, man, it is such a blessing that God, the way God has created mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. That how do I honor that? How do I have praise for that and yeah. see and acknowledge that, that there's some beauty to it? And so just spending times to start to look at what are the positive messages that I've been given when it comes to sex and sexuality and who I am and what makes me me, and then what are the negative ones? Because we have, I mean, I'm married to you, and then I have another female in our house that you're raised in a culture that's, it's not a sex positive message for women, for sure. It's more of an objectification if you go society-wide.
I can't disagree with that.
Right? That yeah. there's an element of, you guys draw attention to yourselves just because you're women. And that's the way the culture is kind of shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Or began. I mean, it's a man-centric world in a lot of ways. But it's just recognizing those are all messages.
Yeah.
And what do I do with my meanings of those messages? Because to shift it, I need to have the ability to start to ask the questions. What do I really believe based on what I was raised in versus where I am now? Mm-hmm. And if you've been around Sexy Marriage Radio Nation for a while, I would hope after almost 8 years on the air, we've challenged meanings or helped frame that challenge of meaning for you.
Man, I hope so, because I want people to have more freedom, right? We have a moral structure that we live by within our house, but just because you have a moral structure you live by doesn't mean you can't have freedom in life, freedom right. in all aspects of life, including that sexual right. arena, right? right. Freedom to explore and have this thing right. that was given to you that can be so beautiful.
So let's land this content this way, because some of this is very individual. That's how it all starts.
Sure.
Right? Is how do I just have the ability to start to look at what are the meanings I've started attributing to things that are determining my behaviors? Because if I can challenge my meanings, I can shift my behaviors. My body can adjust, and I can go different ways with it.
Yeah.
Because there's a tremendous synergy between the body will go where the brain wants it to go in some regards. It's work and it's effort.
Mm-hmm.
The reverse is also true. The brain will go where the body goes, right? It's not always one leads the other. There's a fluidity to this. And so it's learning how can I use where my stance is as best as I can in that moment to steer it a different way. But I want to at least offer up, and maybe we need to expound on this in future shows. So if this is something that resonates with you as you're listening as part of the Academy or extended content, let us know to keep going with this. Feedback at sexymarriageradio.com or 214-702-9565 or jump on the Academy on Slack. But one of the things that you can also do is you can go down some of the meaning challenging path together as a couple. This was mentioned in Dr. Steven Snyder's book, Love Worth Making, that he recommends a lot of times for couples that before sex even begins to happen, when you know there's movement towards sexual encounters, spend time creating a good environment for each of you that's comfortable, that's inviting, that's warm, that doesn't have, you know, you try to eliminate as many distractions as you can. Lay in bed beside each other naked, and before you touch each other or roll over to look at each other or say anything, just breathe and come in touch with your own body and its presence in that moment. And where are you?
Hmm.
And just kind of take stock. I mean, it's kind of like a yoga mindfulness,
right?
You know, centering exercise, but do that beside each other and just kind of see. Do you sense them? Does that stir anything? Is there something going on in my world that, man, I can't get this? If I get that done, maybe that helps clear the area so I can start to be here. And it's truly just trying to create opportunities to steer towards myself in my own presence and then my spouse. So that's a great way to start this.
It is. That could be uncomfortable. I can
likely see, will be.
Yeah, I can see.
Because we don't live in a world that is really centered as people.
Right.
we're usually really frantic and busy.
Yeah.
And when we frantic and busy with sex, it's not really a good recipe.
No.
So it makes sex frantic and busy rather than how do we make it unfold a little more elegantly?
Frantic and busy just so is not
after
enticing.
After you've centered yourself, and you don't have to go that route to bring in the next one, but then the next thing to do is just start to focus on the non-sexual and even the sexual touch with each other. Lay beside each other, and one of you start where whoever it is that's going to be touched, they are on their back, and the other person is usually laying on their side, and you put your hand on their belly or their hip or someplace non-genitalia to start, and then you as the partner laying on your back, put your hand on top of theirs and follow their touch. So your hand's on top of his, if you're the female on her back, and you follow his touch with your hand and with your mind. And you see, what are the meanings of this? If he starts to head towards a breast, does my meaning radars, all these things go off, stop, no, what, you know, because maybe they're just very, very subtle, but I react to it and it shuts down my desire and what could be as a connection. Hmm. And this is a true process. This is not a foreplay path into sex.
Are you supposed to vocalize?
You can.
What's going on?
You can, but typically, if your hand's on top of his and he heads to an area too soon or area you don't want him touching, you can stop his hand because your hand's right there. Then you have the opportunity to see how do each of you deal with that meaning in that moment, because he's going to take it different than you will.
Sure.
Right? He's going to go, oh, here you go. Right? Because there is an element, and I've had this unfold with couples where they talk about as foreplay's unfolding, he's on offense, she's on defense.
Mm.
Or vice versa.
Yikes.
Right? That it's like he goes towards something and she immediately blocks it. So it's just recognizing those are all based on our meanings. And so how do I start to look at the script of what we follow together? And how do I start to challenge that? And that's where a lot of times if you want to go down this route, trying to stay in the non-sexual arena helps ease into this to where genitalia is off limits.
Mm-hmm.
Stay in the other parts of the body. There's still a lot of body around that's non-genitalia.
Right. So talk to each other beforehand before you do this to say, are we putting anything off limits at the beginning?
Right. Yes. Just stay in these arenas.
Yeah. Stay in your lane, bro, so that you can really work through the mental aspect of what's going on.
Yeah. And so that the whole point is this is a path and a journey towards self-discovery that then steers towards marital discovery. Because this is about learning about you and your meanings, your responses, your reactions, and how do you start to challenge them?
And I think that's the bigger thing in, because this, we talk about sex on here, but really it's about more than that.
Yep.
It's your relationship together. It's how you're really getting the message across that I want to be more for you. I want to open up to and be receptive to you in all aspects of the marriage.
Yeah.
So
because you can do this in other areas beyond just sexual. Sexual is kind of like the Mount Everest, if you think about it, of self-development.
Right.
Of I'm trying to scale one of the highest peaks. So I can do this in other areas. And that's what comes to my mind. And when you talked about at the beginning of this, the whole difference between just diet.
Right.
I was raised in a family where the menu was pretty small of what was often presented.
Yeah.
So there was not a lot of variety. There was not a lot of vegetables. And over the years, I've grown to where, you know what? The vegetables, they're good. I like them. That's a challenging of my meanings.
Right.
Of used to, you put green beans in front of me. And it's like, how do I choke those down as fast as I can?
Yeah.
And that even was carried into marriage. As a grown adult, I would still have this element of, I'm going to put all those green beans on a fork full and get it all done right then and there. Rather than, I need to challenge that meaning and see it as, they're actually good. They're good for me too. And I'm good with that.
Yeah.
So It's not about, do I love and savor every moment? It's like, no, this is a better choice. That's challenging a meaning.
Yeah.
And so when you start to see the path, I can start to do this in all areas of my life, which then I can use that to be more for myself and then my spouse and those around me.
Yeah.
Which that's the ultimate goal. Well, it's interesting because if I think about the two different aspects of our show today,
mm-hmm.
it's basically two different shows.
Yeah, it really is.
Because they don't really play off each other, although they could.
Mm.
But thank you again to Dr. Stosny for jumping on and dealing with a topic that, man, it's a tough one to deal with
mm-hmm.
when you're just talking about some of the real pain and struggle and icky side that can play out in married life.
Yeah, how mean we can really be.
Yeah, so right. Kudos to him and his work.
Mm-hmm.
Check out his work if you want more. And if you want more Sexy Marriage Radio, jump on smrnation.com. Join the Academy. And if not, show up next week too. Listen to what we got going on.
Yeah, love to have you listening.
So this has been Sexy Marriage Radio. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to spend it with us. We'll see you next time.